Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Belinda Flowers. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Helen. I keep calling her Star, and I know the difference. I don't know what that's about. Thank you, Savannah, who's not here. She was the original host and wasn't able to make it. And Helen's the fill-in, and she's done an amazing job and has a great spirit. First, I want to thank Lee. Lee's the one who gave my name to the committee. But I also want to thank Lee because people like him and Tapers, I know it's hard work. I watch them and I've helped them, but I've listened to thousands of hours. I don't know about thousands. We'll go with hundreds and hundreds. I'm dramatic and exaggerate still. But, you know, if it wasn't for the Tapers that taped some of these great people, and I know there's a lot of stuff online, but I always try to support the Tapers because I know they work hard. So thank you, Lee, for many reasons. I've been blessed to do quite a few things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have to say Star is one of the most organized, and, you know, letters and emails and text and on top of it, and then I get to meet her and Rachel, and I already love y'all, man. I mean, very much so. And thanks to the rest of the committee. I know it's hard to put these things on. It takes a lot of work, a lot of work. I feel like I have one of the best seats in the house tonight because I get to see all of y'all and the smiles and the faces and the love and a program of recovery that comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you for allowing me to have this view. Yes, I grew up in Louisiana. I knew a few things growing up. I loved horses and dance and gymnastics and softball. And I knew also that I wasn't going to be an alcoholic like my father. You know, I grew up in that alcoholic home, you know, the fear and the chaos and the hollering and the screaming and the yelling. And, you know, it just was a lot. You know, my dad was in the Air Force, ended up retiring in the Air Force. But with that came a lot of stuff for me. So a lot of the things I want to talk about, it's not what makes me alcoholic. In fact, it's some of the things is what made for great drinking, actually. My mom started Al-Anon when I was 3 years old. She started in 1967, and she's, actually next, in March, it'll be 50, is that 55 or 54 years? I can't even do math right now, but it's been a long time, and she's an active member of Al-Anon. She's been a delegate. She's held many service positions. She's very passionate about a home group and service and sponsors a lot of women. And if it weren't for Al-Anon, and my mom's prayers, I probably wouldn't be your speaker tonight. So thank you to every member of Al-Anon in here. So my dad got, you know, my dad did get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1976, and he died about 11 years ago, a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful for that, you know, because I grew up around this program. I went to Alateen. Oh, my God, we had so much fun and the conventions. There were a lot of teenagers or kids running around. We had a good time. I learned to drink with those kids. We had fun. It was awesome, man. But I did. I had met some lifelong friends, and some of those friends are in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous as well now, too. But it's good to see them, you know, and it's good to watch them recover as well. But I knew I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my dad. I mean, it just was dark and bad and loud and crazy and chaotic and stuff, you know. A lot of people don't talk about how I didn't feel like I fit in second grade. Well, nobody does. I mean, did anybody in here feel like they fit in second grade? But what I think happened to me is that I didn't get the handbook like this great author that I like talks about. I didn't get the handbook when I didn't feel like I would fit in and when the alcohol, the drinking was going on in my home. Because my dad quit drinking when I first started drinking. He quit drinking at 12. I mean, when I was 12, I started drinking when I was 12. And, oh, you know, I obviously couldn't drink often, but I sure drank every chance I could drink. And from the moment I drank, I always overshot the mark. I never intended to drink as much as I did when I drank. But once I put alcohol in my body, I didn't know this was going on, but something happened to me. And I got that sense of ease and comfort the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about, and I loved it. I am passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm passionate about the big book and all the other literature. There's phenomenal, phenomenal stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful that, and not just because of my parents, and they're so strong in the traditions and the concepts. jobs and service work, but I have a sponsor who's over 50 years sober and one of the gentlest ladies, unless she doesn't need to be, ladies you'll ever meet. I'm looking around here. I have a few women that I work with and some great women. I've seen a few of them, but I can't wait to see the rest of them that I met in Charleston a couple of months ago. And it's just the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is not only in this room, it's around the world. And thank God for that, because I do know people around the world. And Zoom also added to that. But because I did go to treatment. Treatment's not a requirement, but I'm just grateful that they talked about the big book and talked about getting a sponsor when I got out. But what happened to me, you know, I started drinking and it was fun. And my first consequences, I got suspended in 10th grade because we were going to go drink before school, and go figure, I overshot the mark. I didn't make it to first hour and I got suspended. And, you know, in some youth group that I was a part of, I drank and I got a little slap on my wrist because they caught me. And so my consequences weren't that bad, and consequences is not what makes me alcoholic, right? The big book's pretty clear on that. It's what happens when I drink. And then, but through the years, my drinking started to escalate. My first husband, I thought he drank too much. He drank every day. He had a few beers. He'd stop, mow the grass, come in and eat and watch the news and go to bed, you know? Like, I didn't get that. I just couldn't understand it. But in my mind, the definition of an alcoholic meant you had to drink every day, because that's how my dad drank. So growing up, that's what I thought. You had to drink every day. I'm just pausing for a moment. I feel like I'm all over the place. Some of the things that happened to me when I was younger, again, does not make me alcoholic. You know, molestation and physically abusive relationships, sexually abusive relationships. In fact, those it's really made for great drinking. I mean, I could just drink and get that sense of ease and comfort. In the doctor's opinion, it gives a real good description of alcoholism, and it talks about the obsession of the mind and the phenomenon of craving, and like, what the heck is that? I have this mind that tells me I can drink successfully and a body that reminds me time after time that I can't. I love, I believe in the journey and the whole solution. In fact, I do have my big book here, and it reminds me of what Bill Wilson said in 1941, is that our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of this of the program. And I'm grateful I had a lot of guides and teachers that taught me what that looks like and shared their experience, but I got to watch them. I got to watch them lead by example and practice the principles the program talks about. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous trying to have a better way of life or be, you know, a person of love or any of that. I mean, I just came in because I was desperate. So through the years, I mean, the truth is I drank for over 32 years. Now, I absolutely believe in the singleness of purpose. We are here for one purpose, and that's to help the alcoholic who suffers. And so for me, I had some other stuff as part of my story. And the only reason I'm going to mention this is because of the delusion I was living in. I hadn't drawn a sober breath 8 years before I got sober. And I remember, you know, I went to jail behind, you know, some drugs. I'm going to say it. If I say an outside issue, you know what it is. So, I mean, I went to jail behind that stuff. And so I thought if I could just quit doing that, everything was going to be okay. I mean, I really believed that. I had no idea I had a problem with alcohol. I just thought if I can get off of that, you know, everything's going to be okay. In fact, I remember my mom telling me, she said, you know, Belinda, I'm really concerned about your drinking. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, I don't hardly drink at all. You know, I just was living in this just world of delusion, just a total world of delusion. And I didn't get it. I like, what do you mean? And then she goes on and says a couple of things. And then she says this. She says, Belinda, you know, why don't you pray and ask God? Oh, and the book talks about, I mean, it was me. I mean, I didn't want to talk about that thing. I didn't, you know, God, I mean, if there was one, he wasn't going to help me and so on. But even at that moment, I just really had no idea how to, alcohol was an issue in my life, because I wasn't drinking the way my dad drank. And this is somebody who spent years in Alateen, years around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. it's funny how the mind will just, my mind was so delusional about what it even meant to be alcoholic. I remember when my dad was 20-something years sober and before I got sober, and I said, you know, oh, Dad, let me, you know, he showed me his chip. I said, oh, that's great. I was telling people you still go to AA because it's your family and you've become friends with these people. And he looked at me and said, no, I go to AA because in order to stay sober and help other people. And he used to say stuff like, oh, Belinda, I said, I just want to be happy, Dad. And he's like, oh, happiness is a byproduct of living the right kind of life. And I'm like, whatever. What does that even mean? You know? And so I did. I mean, I spent 32 years drinking. And I found myself in a position where I was living in a household. And by this time, my ex-husband had divorced me because he was trying to get me to stay. But I did stay. I just moved in the other room because it was my house. And by the time I got sober, I had moved a boyfriend in the room with me. I mean, I was just so asleep and so selfish and self-centered. But what happened is that I found myself sitting on the bed. I was out of money. I was out of alcohol. I mean, I remember the last drink of alcohol that I had, and just so miserable. I started to have DTs, and I didn't want to go through the detox again. And I begged them two men to blow my brain out and put me out of my misery. That was the best solution I can have to the way I was feeling and the way I was living life. I had tried every imaginable remedy to make my life work and lived this lie and delusion all along that brought me to the depths of darkness. That ick on the inside. I don't know about you, but if you think about it, maybe you got an ick like I had. I can have that ick sober. It's just this, ugh. And I'm looking for the sense of ease and comfort, and it came in alcohol. But I asked him to blow my head off, and then I had just, and it didn't happen by me, it happened to me. And I called my little mommy and daddy, and I said, I need some help. I said, there's a place an hour away that will take me to a detox facility. Now, here's the truth. I didn't go to that detox facility because I wanted to get sober. I went to it because I didn't want to go through the withdrawals again. The thought of that was just over the top. And so my little mommy and daddy came pick me up before I was even packed. And I remember on the way, Dad says, Belinda, you're an alcoholic or a drug addict? You know, good AA is going to ask that question, right? And I said, oh, I'm a drug addict, Daddy. And he didn't say anything, and I went on. And I get to that detox facility, and I brought two big books of Alcoholics Anonymous with me. I don't know why, or I think my first husband had gotten one, and then I don't know where the second one came from, but somehow within I knew that was a solution. I had never read one. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, one about 7 months before I got sober, because I wanted to quit that stuff. And I said if I couldn't quit it on my own, I'd go to a meeting. If I couldn't quit it after, you know, in AA, AA didn't work for me that day, by the way. It didn't help that I was loaded that day, but, and I said if AA didn't work, then I'd go to treatment. And again, I didn't plan on going to treatment. I just didn't want to go through that horrible feeling of the withdrawals again. And so I ended up in that detox facility, and a beautiful group of members of Alcoholics Anonymous came in the first night I was there. And I don't remember what they said. They all brought their little blue book in and everything. But what I do remember one guy said is he had just gotten out of treatment the week before, and he had 5 weeks of sobriety. 5 weeks of sobriety. I think that guy saved my life. I don't know that I knew it then, but I know it now. Because when I sat there, or when I look back, I had drank for 32 years. From the moment of my first drink to the moment I sat in that detox facility, I'd not gone 5 weeks without drinking. I could never manage that long. And of course, towards the end, it didn't last, you know, it was hours, if anything. And so that guy saved my life. I've been blessed to be Area 27, which is the state of Louisiana. I've held a few positions at Area, and one of them was treatment committee. And one of the biggest questions I always get asked is, how much time do you have to carry a message in a treatment facility? And it's asked often, and I think there's some rigid rules. I believe for sure we have to follow whatever the rules the treatment center says, but had somebody said, oh no, you've got to have 6 months or a year to go in that detox facility, I may not be your speaker tonight. And so I'm thankful. I think everyone in this room has a purpose. The people with long-term sobriety, or whether you have a day, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, or welcome back. So I had no intention on getting sober, and 5 days in, and I don't know, I ended up in a treatment center. You know, again, it wasn't even, I didn't swear off of alcohol, it just happened. I ended up in a treatment center. Treatment center is not a requirement, it just was for me. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm grateful I went to one that we sat in class, and they brought us through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous while we sat in class Monday through Friday from 8 to 4. They broke down the book, and they broke down the words, and they talked about service and history of Alcoholics Anonymous. We worked all the steps in there. Oh, I took my name tag off because I talk like this, and stuff's going to go flying. It just did. But we worked all the steps in there. We had a sponsor that came in and sat with me for hours to listen to the inventory. I mean, words like phenomenon of craving and allergy and the doctor's opinion. I mean, they just broke it down. And again, that's not Alcoholics Anonymous, but what it did was lay a great foundation. And they talked about getting out and getting a home group and getting a sponsor. And I'm so grateful, overly grateful for that treatment center. And I had a home that I could have gone back to, but I chose to go to a sober living. And that's not a requirement either, just part of my story. But I'm grateful for that, because they required you to go to meetings and all of that. And I remember sitting in that sober living house one day and, you know, talking to the boyfriend that went to treatment with me. I was on the phone. Of course, I snuck him in one night to that sober living. I mean, that's just how, you know, what I do sober. But I'm talking to him on the phone. I got mad and I break the phone and I throw it across the room. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I not doing? Well, I don't want to live sober and angry, right? What's going on? And what one of the earlier realizations in that is that I'm not doing the readings and the quiet time that they were talking about. And so that was the first awakening that I needed to do something different. There's a couple of things in the big book that just a couple of sentences I like to read. In the foreword to the first edition, it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That's the purpose of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful that I was taught for that. It shows us precisely how to do it. The directions are in here. The examples are in here. The experiences are in here. And then the other part, you know, we talk about relapsers. I mean, by the grace of God, not counting that one meeting I went to loaded, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and have managed only by God's grace to stay sober one day at a time. Just like my dad actually did that. I know there's a lot of people that do that. And so I just want to remind you, if you've been in and out or in and out, in the foreword to the second edition, it says it also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. So I ask you the question, do you want permanent recovery or temporary recovery? Because the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous and other people's experience shows that we can have permanent recovery. Here's another part in the book that I always think about too. It talks about we can go on to the bitter end, and that's what I was doing. I was going on to the bitter end trying to blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation, because everything was intolerable. I can even do that sober. I can try to blot out the consciousness of the intolerable situation sober. So that's one alternative. And the second alternative is to accept spiritual help. And that means, like, you got to talk about that God thing again. So when I look at the steps and my experience through them, obviously they mean different things through the years. When I first got sober, and they talk about I'm powerless, I am powerless over alcohol, 100%. I am still powerless over alcohol. What does that mean to me? That of myself, the power that I have, which is none, I can't not drink. Or once I start drinking, I can't control the amount I take. I have no power. No human power, the book describes it as. And my life's unmanageable, not just when I was drinking. It is currently unmanageable when I am managing on my own. So any problem I have sober, I can always look back to a step one problem. I'm powerless. But I live in this delusion that I have power and the illusion I'm controlling it. Gets me in trouble all the time. You know? And so if I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable, well, and this obsession of the mind, not just around drinking, but man, sober, I've got this mind that keeps on going, this narrative, this story, this thing that just doesn't stop. I have this belief system that is driving me. I think you should, and you shouldn't, and you must, and he must, and mom should. And I mean, I got this long list. Make me mad, and it's going to go. And I am not of sound mind around alcohol, but I cannot be of sound mind around anything. And so I'm grateful that step one, the rigorous honesty that step one talks about, is I have to fully concede to my innermost self that I am powerless over alcohol. But for me, I like to add, I have no power. In fact, the book is clear. We read it in almost every meeting and how it works. It says there is one that has all power. One. That one is God. So if there's one that has all power, that implies I don't have any, nor do, well, I don't know about y'all. I don't have any. I think I know about y'all, though. And so when I can fully concede the powerlessness in any situation, when I get here or when I am currently here, that will always move me into this in step two. And I didn't believe anything. I believed the program worked for my dad. I had a couple of guys that I would drink with, and they got sober, you know, one a year and a half before me, another one 5 years before me. And I thought these dudes were way worse than me. Oh, my God. You know, they were way, I don't know if y'all had any of those. They were way, my ego and grandiosity, drunk or sober for that matter, is just can be really huge. And so these guys, you know, when I watch them and come in, and it just helped me see that maybe this program can work for me too. And so when step two says we came to believe, I didn't know if I believed. I believed it worked for you. I believed it worked for my dad and them two guys. And so, but they just kept moving me through the steps. We came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And so they asked me simple questions like, what's more powerful than you? And, you know, I was looking at the clouds in the skies. Well, I can't produce that, nor any other human. How about the waves in the ocean? You know, just some simple stuff, right? Waves are crashing. I can't make the waves not crash. So it helped me see, one, I'm not the power I thought I was. But it helped me see that there are other powers greater than me. And so I didn't have to believe anything. In fact, the big book says, you know, do you believe or are you willing to believe? The gift of desperation that my alcoholism brought me to created the willingness for me to believe. I was willing to believe anything. Gift of desperation spells God. I didn't want to talk about that. I had this idea and these prejudices about this God idea. I didn't think he would help somebody like me. I'd done so much wrong and bad and yada, yada, yada that, you know, so I'm grateful y'all didn't tell me what I had to believe. Y'all just taught me that the alternative is death for me, and I didn't want to die anymore. And I didn't want to live sober and angry, which I still get angry, don't get me wrong. And so that step two decision, you know, a lot of things at first was through the motions. I'm grateful I have a sponsor and other spiritual guides. I've been having the sponsor the same time. She's 87 years old, and I think I can get something by her sometimes, and nope. And but I've been through the steps with her, and I, you know, actually, and she'll do some other things. But I've been blessed to have other women bring me through the steps, and there just seems to be a different experience every time and a different shift every time. It's like my spirit continues to awaken, right? Because I like how some speakers call it, we're at this thawing out stage. And when I got sober, I didn't know what I was feeling. I knew how to get angry, but I didn't know any of that, right? And so then step two, if I'm insane, basically, And I got to get connected to this power. And then it moves me into step three, the step three, the decision that I'm going to turn this mind, my will and my life over to care of God. It's like, what does that even mean? You know what I mean? A God as I understand him. And man, that was a scary proposition until they took me through the big book, pages 60 to 63. We talk a lot about the third step prayer, but we're missing the meat of that chunk of stuff that describes me. You want to know about me? Helen kept asking, what about me? And I put her by Liz so Liz can tell her about me. But if you want to know about me, read the pages 60 to 63, because that's me. My motive's good, but I am the actor. And I am trying to arrange the whole show to suit me. Like I was saying, if you just uncross your legs and cross yours and talk louder and don't talk, put the toilet paper on the right way. You know, I mean, I just have so many ideas. And if you do the things that Belinda wishes, things are going to be great. And I'm going to be kind and loving and gracious, right? But as soon as the toilet paper is on the wrong way, we've been having a long conversation. It's the wrong way in our room. But the cool deal is I don't have to turn it to the right way anymore. But, I mean, it's just like, so, I mean, if things are going my way, I'm going to be kind and loving and gracious. But as soon as things don't go my way, I'm going to flip. And I'm going to be mean and egotistical and arrogant and add all the other character defects, right? But really, all I'm trying to do is seize by force satisfaction and happiness out of this world, because I want both. Oh, you want to be right or you want to be happy, Belinda? I want to be both. I want to be right and happy. Like, I'm not a halfway kind of gal. But I'm going to try to seize satisfaction and happiness out of this world by managing well. Not only my life, but your life too. And I mean, it's mind-blowing. And I'm stepping on people's toes and they're trying to retaliate. But the book's real clear. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of my trouble. The root of my trouble is selfishness, self-centeredness. And my favorite line, and it has been, it changes. Whatever my truth that I'm sharing today is my truth today, it might be different tomorrow. But for a while, one of my favorite lines in the big book, it says, the alcoholic, that would be me, is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Though I usually don't think so. You know what somebody had the nerve to tell me the other day when I called her? She's guiding me through the work right now. She said, Belinda, you're whiny. I'm like, I was offended, not really, but I was just like, you know, I mean, I am an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I don't think so. I can see it in you. I can see it in my fiancé or my mom or the driver in front of me. I mean, it just kind of blows my mind and it baffles me. It still baffles me when I'm like, oh my gosh, I can do and say some things and I'm so asleep I don't even notice, and I'm so grateful that I have people who have spiritual consent in my life that can pull me aside and say, hey, Belinda, do you know when you bought that thing from that artist and you made the decision to buy it and she told you how much it was and you said something like, well, that's ridiculous, and bought it anyway? Do you think, Nate? And I'm like, oh. I mean, I had an idea what it should have cost, and then I voice it. I mean, how selfish and self-centeredness. That's sober, and that's how I can walk around today. But I'm grateful I have people in my life that can help me see that. Selfishness, self-centeredness. Extreme. I'm so asleep, I don't know it. It's just, it baffles me when I awaken to it. It really does. So when I'm looking at this work, you know, because really what is a decision, honestly? It is for me to get a relationship with this power, to get connected to this power. So currently, I believe I can make a decision, a third step decision, on a regular basis. And for me, I have to, because I'm a quick forgetter. And so I need to look and see. So one day at a time, I can choose to establish and develop that relationship with the God of my understanding. And that's just how it has to be for me. The powerlessness, unmanageability, my insanity will move me to want to, the gift of desperation moves me want to have something different. And so then that also, when I see how my life is just total chaos, dramatic, egotistical, and all this stuff, extreme example, self will run riot then, right? That also moves me into the fourth step. And the fourth step is, over time, my gosh, the first fourth step was so surfacey and, you know, I just did it and check. I had check sheets and I had check sheets. I don't know what y'all had. Check sheets and treatment and I did it. I did everything they asked me to do and I, you know, and I'm grateful that I've been taught that there's other directions in the big book when it comes to inventory. But you know what? That first inventory worked for me long enough to stay sober, to move, and to have other directions by people who knew the work the way I've been taught. But the inventory, you know, it's funny because it says resentment's the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It's deadly. It's poison. It kills. I mean, that's some powerful stuff. That's how important resentment is. I love me some resentment from time to time. I mean, my brother made me mad not long ago, brought up some stuff from 40 years ago, and da-da-da-da, and but 36 hours, I mean, that's pretty good for me, right? I went to two meetings, I worked with two sponsees, you know, I talked to my guide, and da-da-da. But I tell you what, it feeds the soul in a negative way. I suffer from a soul sickness. That ick on the inside is a soul sickness. The inventory is about clearing away the soul sickness, unlearning the stuff I've perfected this art of belief system, right? The book talks about this God thing and says, we beg of you to lay aside your prejudices. I need to lay aside prejudices about anything because I live in this state of I think I know. Any people in here think y'all know? I mean, like, we are some knowers, right? And but that inventory, you know, I love the prayer in the back of the book and people talk about page 552. It's a great prayer. I've used it. But that resentment prayer, I can't wish this resentment away any more than I can alcohol. I have to have God's help. And I'm grateful there's a prayer in there because it gives me an opportunity to go to this God of my understanding to pray and ask him to help, to remove this from me, to save me from being angry. I was taught the prayer in the back of the big book says, change you. Give you health, prosperity, and happiness. But the resentment prayer says, change me. Help me show them the same love, patience, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Uses words like love and tolerance of others is my code. Others. It doesn't say, and it uses words like all. Like all people. Like really? I can love and tolerate Star. She's easy to love and tolerate. But make me mad? It says all people, but of myself I can't. I lack the power. I have to go to the power that changes me, helps me show them the same love, patience, and tolerance I'd cheerfully grant a sick friend. You know, and then the book uses words like fear and the evil and corroding thread, the fabric of my existence is shot through with it. Oh my God, I'm walking around, I'm a state of fear. I'm either running, I'm running by this belief system that's driven by fear, or I'm led by God. Typically it's the driven part. But over time and through the work and sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, sometimes better than others, it moves me to be led more by God, which is love. I can dress it up. The spiritual malady manifests in all kind of different forms. Anger, procrastination, avoidance, control, manipulation, you know, the long list. But again, I can't wish the fear away any more than I could alcohol. I can't say, wait, go away, fear, go away. I have to have God's help. I learned how to pray in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and by coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's so many prayers throughout the book. Anytime the book says we ask, that means we pray. When I was mad at my brother not long ago, I was saying some prayers that are on page 69 and 70. That's under the sex inventory. But it's just, God, mold my ideals and help me live up to them. So by learning the prayers and learning them intellectually, it gradually started becoming working part of my mind. And so after the fear part, it goes into the sex part. Yes, sex. This is now about sex. My sex conduct was horrible when I first got sober. horrible. At one point, I was even 3 years sober, and I despised people who dated newcomers. It's wrong. You don't do it. You're going to kill them. Da-da-da-da. How dare she? I can't believe she's 20 years sober and dating this guy. Until he walked in. And, yeah, 3 years sober, and I dated the new guy. I'm not proud of it. I'm not proud of it. Neither one of us got drunk over it, and that's only by the grace of God. We worry about the newcomer getting drunk over it, but I've seen many people who have time get drunk over it, too. Right? You know, if resentment's the number one offender, deadly poison kills, destroys, all those massive words, and fear is the evil and corroding thread, under the sex inventory, there are three prayers. There are three prayers in that portion. It talks about sex is very troublesome. We all have different ideas. Currently, everybody in this room probably has a different idea. One thing that stands out to me that I'm probably your speaker, I'm probably only sober in here tonight, because my sponsor did exactly what the book said. She wasn't the arbiter of my sex conduct. I don't know if you need to stay out of a relationship for a year or get in one or don't or date the newcomer or not. There's a lot of things that probably aren't a good idea. But what my sponsor did do is take me through the work. And every time I wrote the 9 questions just as exactly as described in the big book. And I said those 3 prayers and I memorized those 3 prayers and I used them often. She provided me a safe place to go to be able to be honest. I see so many times my experience of watching others and their sponsor or whoever, you know, don't date for a year or you need to stop that. They're lying then. They start lying. I'm just so grateful she provided me a space that I can go to and be authentic and really tell her what I was up to and thinking and doing. She never fussed at me or pointed my finger and shame on you. None of that. Not even with the newcomer. She would ask me questions. Does this help your spirit grow in a positive way or a negative way? Does this help you help other alcoholics in a positive way or a negative way? Does this help you with your relationship with God or not? Does this heal your soul sickness? Or does it make it fester and get worse? She would ask me questions and she would have me do the work and always have me bring it back to God. I'm so grateful for her and other people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have been some wonderful, passionate, gentle guides for me. I will never be able to say enough about that. And with that, she allowed me the space to share the inventory with her, to be able to share authentically with me. But God's the one who graced me with an open-mindedness and a willingness to be able to do this. Not always honestly. Mostly honest with her. There was one time I had some inventory or something, an assignment I was supposed to do. I was newly sober, and she said, and so I showed up at her house without it done, and I had the plan driving over there. I was going to lie to her. I was going to tell her I left it on the bed. And I got there, and I said, I just want you to know I was going to tell you I left it on the bed, but it's a lie. I didn't do it. But I'm so grateful for that. You know, and then there's 6 and 7 out of the book. I did that in treatment. It was quick. I didn't know what this stuff meant. And sit quiet for an hour. Are you kidding me? What are you talking about? But I think life, living life, trying to look at 6 and 7 to remain willing to be able to go to the God of my understanding, to ask for these things to be removed, is also a continued part of my journey. I love other books. There's other books. I won't mention names because I believe in our conference approved literature, but there are many other books that are helpful books too, that guide me and lead me and help move me towards a less understanding of God, but, a different relationship. My first amends list was very long my first harm list was very long. A lot of it came off the inventory. It's pretty easy to pull it off of there, but there were some other financial amends and stuff like that, or amends that I had to make because I hurt people, but they didn't make me mad. So But I needed y'all to guide me through all of this stuff. I needed y'all to show me what the truth was and where I'm lying to myself and throw some stuff to me as for some considerations and use words like, Belinda, is it possible? Maybe? Have you considered? And those are words that help me protected, defensive person be able to be opened to some other possibilities. There's a few amends that I want to talk about. And the first one, my dad, he gave me my first one-year chip. And I had that one-year chip for several years because he had passed when I was a year and a half sober. And then I remember what y'all taught me. You can't keep it, Belinda, unless you give it away. And finally, I think I was about 4 or 5 years sober, I gave it to a woman that I was working with. And she gave it to a woman she's working with, so it's still moving around. FYI, remember, I'm selfish, self-centered. I still have his last 33-year chip and his Zippo lighter that has a serenity prayer that they gave him for his 1 year. So I'm keeping that. I'm not. Maybe one day I'll give it away, but not now. But he was diagnosed with cancer when I was 6 months sober and went through the treatments and all of that. And, I had to shave his hair when he was losing it. And when he didn't have the strength to get up, I had to help him up and stuff like that. And I'm just grateful I was able to make a verbal amends to him before he died. And I have my mom's permission to say this. It was my dad that molested me, and he molested me after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just because we come in here doesn't mean we get well. Once you take my ease and comfort away, I'm going to find it in some other way if I don't find it in a spiritual solution. And so when I made amends to him, I didn't bring up the fact that he molested me, but people ask me all the time, did your dad make amends to you? And the answer is no. Obviously, my dad didn't have to make amends to me to stay sober. But I knew I had to make amends to him. Now, I have a belief system about my dad, and he didn't seem like the most happy, joyous, and free person. He helped a lot of people, but I did not feel like he was happy, joyous, and free. Now, I may be wrong, and I only share that because I get sober doesn't mean the soul sickness automatically goes away. And so when I was newly sober and for the first 3 years, my dad was a good dad and treating me well. And I just had that belief. That's what I had to believe growing up, the way I grew up and what happened to me and all of those things. And he was a good dad and treating me good and da 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 da. And then and somebody had me, you know, now he's deceased and now somebody's having me, you want me to write inventory on my dad? Why? He's dead. I mean, that's just how like I was, like he's dead. And they're like, no, you might want to write. And so I did. And what happened to me on that one, I mean, my dad became an ass. I mean, everything, he was mean and egotistical and angry and blah, 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 blah. And I kept that belief for about another 6 years. Even sober, I cannot differentiate the truth from the false. In the doctor's opinion, it says we can't differentiate the truth from the false. My life seems the only normal one. Even sober, I can take any part of this literature and have a current experience with it. The bedevilments. And look at the bedevilments and ask myself, am I having trouble with personal relations? Can I make a living? And can I be useful? Am I afraid of misery and depression? So I can look at this stuff sober. So here I am faced with this. I just laugh because a lot of times I talk, I'm in a blackout. I am fully awake right now. And when I do that, I go blank. So just give me a minute. I'm not sure where I was, but I guess I'm not supposed to be there. So, making amends to my dad and the beliefs and the lies I was telling myself, and And so fast forward again, and then I'm like 11 years sober, and I'd be doggone, and if another woman is bringing me through the steps and asked me to write another inventory on my dad, I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, and honestly, I don't remember right now if it was an inventory, but what she wanted me to do was to write out an amends to my dad. I already made amends to him, but she knew me through the years, and she knew me probably better than I knew me. And she wanted me to write a letter, an amends letter to my dad with the information I had then. And I'm here to say if anybody ever wants to see this after the meeting because you have a similar experience, I'd be happy to show it to you. I have it on my phone. But what happened in that letter, I was able to genuinely make amends and write it out from a place of compassion and love. I was able to see my dad for the first time with a real compassion and understanding, with a forgiving heart. I was able to thank him for what happened to me, because those are the things that allow me to help people in Alcoholics Anonymous now too. It was the first time I really could see, I could visualize the darkness in my dad's soul, but see the light screaming to get out. I can see it in people. I can see it in here today. I'm so grateful there were people and members of Alcoholics Anonymous that helped my light get out. You know, my niece died. I was 60-something days sober, and my niece took some pills, passed out in the car in South Louisiana. It happened to be 22 degrees outside, and she froze to death. Beautiful, beautiful girl. And a year of her anniversary of her death, the family got together, and I knew I owed her amends. I'd done the work. I'd ran it by somebody. I just, you know, I had it when she died. I'd already had my amends ready to make amends. And, but I didn't get to it. And so the year of her, when we celebrated her life and sent up helium balloons, one of my family members says, let's write short little notes and send them up too. And of course, again, this is happening to me, not by me. And we write little notes, and I made an amends on that little note. And I'm like, Chastity, I said, you know, I owe you an amends. I was wrong for not being a good aunt and giving you alcohol and drugs when you're a minor and not leading by example. You know, a short list, a little piece of paper. But what I wrote on that piece of paper, I said that with God's help, I'll spend the rest of my life trying to help people so that they don't die like her. And fast forward 10 years after that or so, her brother, my nephew, had been in prison. And my mom gave him a talk that I had done and heard this story. And he sent me a message from prison. And he said he heard that talk. And he said, I want you to know, as the person who was closest to her, which was true, she had no ill feelings towards you. She loved you. And as the person closest to her, I want you to know that. There is nothing to forgive, Belinda. How does that happen? I was free when I made that amends. But oh my God, I can't tell you the profound impact when he sent me that. You know, there's a couple times in the book that says we have to be willing. I don't know what it says, we. It talks about, am I willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? Yes. Sometimes I stomp my feet, but I'm also often, not always, willing to go to any lengths to establish and develop a relationship with the God of my understanding. And through this process, and people, well, let me talk about people again. When I came in here, I was so full of guilt, remorse, and shame, which made me restless, irritable, and discontented, right? And that guilt, remorse, and shame, and I had no compassion for myself and no forgiveness. And I'm grateful to somebody, oh, Belinda, you gotta, you know, they taught me to forgive you. And by forgiving you, I was awakened one day. It's like, oh my gosh, the spirit of forgiveness just starts happening. Step 10, Bob and I are going to do a workshop tomorrow on 10, 11, and 12, but basically step 10 for me currently is just a a way to try to stay awake and aware to what's really going on with me. To that undisciplined self that I am. Remember that extreme example of self will run riot. And I miss it. I miss it. I'm grateful there's some questions in the big book that, you know, like, where am I selfish, dishonest, resentful, and afraid? But again, I can't make them go away. I love the prayer. Another prayer, go figure. It says we ask God at once to remove these. I don't save that for tonight. I do it throughout my day. It uses words like promptly and at once. Because any resentment or fear or conduct, you know, conduct where I'm going against my morals and values, I feel like it's blocking me from God. I'm so grateful for step 11. I'm grateful that I have a sponsor that always from the beginning. I used to tell people, oh, you can work this, you know, you can work step 11 out of order. I don't know about that. But what I do believe is that we can start praying immediately. There's no right way or wrong way. I love how the book says we beg of you to lay aside prejudices. Beg you. Not just, you know, beg. That's a strong word. There's a nightly review. There's some questions to ask. There's prayers or corrective measures in God's forgiveness, which we take into the morning. I love waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep. I don't sleep very good already, but it allows me more time to read other spiritual books. Allows me more time to do two-way prayer or write or meditate. And I wouldn't do without that any more than I would food or water. Of myself, I am nothing. I need to stay connected to that power. And so people like think they got to meditate with me like I do or whatever. And I talk one-on-one with a lot of people about meditation. And I think I kind of overwhelm them. But I always give them a simple meditation, and you do not have to do this with me, but if you're willing to do this with me, it'll take maybe 30 seconds if you just close your eyes and take a deep breath in and breathe in love and breathe out fear. Breathe in love and breathe out fear. Breathe in love. And breathe out fear. Now just open your eyes for a minute. And feel the room. I feel it. The whole room shifted. There's a stillness in it that wasn't in it right before we did that. My first beginning meditations when I was first sober, I set a timer for 3 minutes and just do that. My mind wonders. My mind still wonders in meditation. It's not about no thought at all. It's about not getting attached to the thoughts. There's many, many forms. Stare at a tree. Watch the leaves blow and think, I don't know, God's... I like looking at like God's waving at me when I see that. There's so many forms. Talk to someone and ask what their practices are. But more important, try to have an experience. And don't get discouraged because it takes days, weeks, months, or even years. But I'm so grateful that I've been taught and have God has graced me again to have a consistent prayer meditation life. That step 11 says sought through prayer and meditation. I got lots of opinions and I'm going to give you this one. I think meditation's the least used tool in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think a lot of times it's because people fear it or they don't know. I didn't know. We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. Because I'm powerless, I need His power. Step 12, the actual step. I went blank. I was trying to check my time, that's why. But I will go to page 60 and I'll read it word for word. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. the result, not a result. I don't know anyone who hasn't had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Maybe, you know, thoroughly. And it says we tried to carry this message. What message? The message is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We try to carry this message to alcoholic and to practice these principles in all our affairs, not just the AA life. The home life tends to be harder for me. My fiance just had major surgery, and man, I am impatient. I mean, talking about major surgery, and I've got to serve a man. Oh, I'm so grateful the book says how we may meet their needs, and I can put spiritual needs in front of it. But it's been a great opportunity for me to grow closer to God and pause, and I haven't had to make one amends yet, which baffles me. I'm grateful there's three legacies. There's a program of recovery, which are the 12 steps. There's a program of unity, which are the traditions that help keep Alcoholics Anonymous around. I'm grateful my dad and mom were passionate about that, because if they weren't, I don't know, maybe AA wouldn't have been around for me. And then the 12 concepts. You shouldn't be, I was taught, you know, Belinda, you shouldn't be born in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's plenty to do. The committee members probably can tell you that. Yeah, you know, my mind will just go blank, but now I know it's blank because God's done. So I want to thank y'all all for having me again. Thank you very much to the committee.